Hello, welcome. My name is Divine. This is our fourth Divine Intervention episode. Today I'll be talking about hematology. I have about 10 or 11 keyword slides I want to go over. And just as sort of like a forewarning, this is probably one of those podcasts that you don't want to listen to at elevated speeds, which I know we all do as medical students, or I guess as healthcare professionals, because this one contains a fair number of head scratchers. But if you sort of try to follow along, things will make perfect sense. One, two, you would have very little you actually do need to memorize, and three, you'll actually be able to make some inroads into other, I guess, fields of learning like biochem or cell biology, okay? Because those are the ways they try to integrate this material on board exams. And so let's go ahead and start. So the first question says, slide 1A, genetics of alpha and beta thalassemias, right? So the thalassemias are essentially problems involving globin gene production, okay? And remember that normal hemoglobin, that's hemoglobin A, is alpha 2 beta 2, okay? So if you have problems with alpha gene production, that's alpha thalassemia. If you have problems with beta globin gene production, that is beta thalassemia, okay? And in general, alpha thalassemia is found primarily in like West Africans and in Asians, okay? But beta thalassemia is found more in the Mediterranean population. So, the quick genetics that I want to talk about here is that we have alpha chains. Basically, we have like four genes that, actually, I guess two genes that control the production of alpha chains. We get two genes from mom, two genes from dad, so we have four genes total. But for the beta globin chain in hemoglobin, we do in fact have only one gene. Okay, and again, if you get one from mom and one from dad, okay, you form you have two genes total. And the problem with alpha thalassemias is, in general, you have like a gene deletion that prevents you from making alpha, the alpha chain in hemoglobin. But in beta thalassemia, it's almost always like you're making less beta globin, and it usually arises, at least I will say in terms of the classically tested concept on exams, in the context of a splicing defect. So splicing defects, may you're not necessarily having any problem on the gene transcription level, but you're having problems more with the pre-translational regulation of the gene product. So just sort of something to keep in mind there. Now, the protective antecedents with thalassemias, people think that thalassemias are common in like African countries because it protects against the bug, that one of the bugs that causes malaria, okay, Plasmodium falciparum. Remember that Plasmodium species are the stain are positive with a Gims's stain, okay? So if you see like an exam question that says thick and thin smears, blah blah blah, think about like Plasmodium species and also Babesia species. Remember, Babesia is carried by the Ixodes tick that also carries Lyme disease. That's Borrelia burgdorferi and anaplasmosis. Okay, so let's talk about the number of the different permutations for alpha thalassemia. So the thing is, we said there are four genes, right? And basically, you have problems based on the number of genes that are gone, the number of gene deletions you have. In general, if you have only one or two gene deletion, you have like a very subclinical course. In fact, those patients are usually symptomatic. But if you then getting to losing 3 or 4 genes, then you have some very serious problems. But let's first discuss what happens with losing 2 genes. So if you think about it, you can lose 2 genes in one of 2 ways. You can lose both genes, I guess, in one of 3 ways. So you can lose both genes on dad's chromosome, like the chromosome you get from dad. That's a cis mutation. Or you could lose both genes from mom's chromosome, the chromosome you get from mom. That's also a cis mutation. Or you could lose one gene from dad and one gene from mom's chromosomes. Okay, that's a transmutation. Those cis mutations are commonly found in Asians, okay, but the transmutations are commonly found in West Africans. Now, why is that important? The reasoning there is that the cis mutations are usually more severe than the transmutations, because the way I sort of think of it is, it's like if you're losing one gene from mom or from dad, it's like you have like some, like one other gene to sort of help you out somewhere. But if you're losing both from mom, let's assume dad has like not so perfect genes, and you don't have like some good genes from mom to counterbalance that, you could sort of envision how you could run into troubles with that. Okay. And if you lose 3 genes, 3 alpha chain genes, you have something known as hemoglobin H disease. Okay, and in hemoglobin H disease, the thing that happens is that because there is very few alpha genes around, beta globin says, gotta marry someone. So beta globins begin to pair up with themselves. Okay, so you form like beta 4 tetramers, and that's the classic finding on a hemoglobin electrophoresis in a person that has 3 genes gone. And just real quick, if you have 2 genes gone, 2 alpha genes gone, that is what is known as alpha thalassemia trait. So just something to keep in mind. Now, if you lose all 4 genes, unfortunately, the child is not born. And the reasoning behind that is, if you really think about the hemoglobin that's present in utero, hemoglobin F, it contains alpha 2 and gamma 2. If you have no alpha genes whatsoever, then you begin to have the gamma globin chains pairing up with each other to form gamma 4, okay? And basically, those kids have like very severe anemia in utero. They get like hydrops fetalis and all that badness, and they're just basically never born, okay? It's lethal in utero. Now, another question I pose after this is, how can a child of 2 alpha thal trait parents have hemoglobin BARTs? So hemoglobin BARTs, sorry I didn't mention this earlier, is the problem you get when you lose all 4 alpha chain genes. Hemoglobin H disease is the problem you get when you lose 3 alpha chain genes. So ask yourself, so this is one very nice way they can test genetics and cell biology on your exam. For a kid to have hemoglobin BARTs and have 2 parents that have alpha thalassemia trait, which is what you get when you have 2 alpha genes gone, you could potentially imagine that the kid has 2 parents that both have the cis alpha thal trait, right? So what do I mean by cis? Again, by cis, I mean that, oh, each parent, like the mom had only 2 copies of the alpha gene, and she potentially lost like the other 2 copies from like one chromosome, either from mom only or from dad only, right? And then for dad, he also had 2 copies lost of the alpha chain gene, and he probably lost it all from either his dad's chromosomes or from his mom's chromosomes. So if the genetic material that is passed on from the parents to the fetus is the defective gene that has lost both chromosomes, if the chromosome that was passed on from mom to the fetus or from dad to the fetus was the chromosome that lacked those 2 alpha chain genes, then the kid will essentially have no alpha chain genes, and they will have hemoglobin BARTs, which again, like I said, is lethal in utero. Now, beta thal minor, right? So we said there are 2 total beta thalassemia genes. If you lose one, you have something called beta thal minor, okay? And if you have less beta globin available, right, anything that contains beta globin gene chains will go down, and anything that does not contain beta globin chains will go up, right? So hemoglobin A, we said it's alpha 2 beta 2, so your hemoglobin A levels go down a little in beta thal minor. Your hemoglobin A2 level, so remember hemoglobin A2 is alpha 2 delta 2, that goes up in beta thal minor. And remember hemoglobin F is alpha 2 gamma 2, that also goes up in beta thal minor. Okay, and if you're trying to compare iron deficiency anemia and beta thal minor, right, because both of them will present as a microcytic hypochromic anemia, some things that can help is that the iron studies in iron deficiency anemia are abnormal, but the iron studies in beta thal minor are totally normal. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that if you check like the ferritin and the serum iron and the serum transferring saturation and all that fun stuff, it's all normal in beta thalassemia. And another thing that may also help with differentiating iron deficiency anemia from beta thalassemia minor is the fact that in beta thal minor, what was I thinking of with this? Well, let's see. Yes. So in beta thal minor, you may occasionally find target cells on a microscopic blood smear. So that's another way to tell beta thal minor apart from iron deficiency anemia. Okay. Yeah, sorry if you with all these ums and ahs. Most of these lectures, I'm giving them from memory. Okay, so beta thal major is when you've lost both beta chains, so both of the genes are gone. And most of those problems with beta thal major actually show up 6 months after birth. The reasoning behind that is for the first 6 months of life, you still depend primarily on hemoglobin F, which has alpha 2 gamma 2. So you don't necessarily have this big need for beta globin chains until about 6 months after you're born. Okay, but for hemoglobin H disease, where you've lost 3 of your 4 alpha globin chains, you begin to run into trouble from birth, because again at birth you need alpha chains for that fancy hemoglobin F. If you have fewer alpha chains, then you'll begin to have very severe anemias, a very severe anemia from the time you were born. Okay, and again, with regards to the smear findings, you classically find target cells in the thalassemias. Although remember that target cells are also found like in liver disease, for example. And these thalassemias classically present in a kid that has like some kind of hemolytic anemia. They have increased reticulocytes because they are destroying their red cells left, right, and center. And in addition, these kids usually have like this crew cut appearance on imaging, right? Because they have a lot of extramedullary hematopoiesis, because it's like, oh, you need so much hemoglobin, you need so many red cells, because their lifespan is sort of shorter because they are destroyed quickly. So you begin to make red cells in areas where you ordinarily don't do that in major quantity, like the bones that line your skull and things like that. So next slide. Hemoglobin electrophoresis findings in beta thal major, right? So we said in beta thal minor, your hemoglobin A goes down, but your hemoglobin A2 and F go up. In beta thal major, you actually have an increase in hemoglobin A2 and hemoglobin F, more severe increases, but you actually have absolutely no hemoglobin A on hemoglobin electrophoresis. And again, because hemoglobin A has alpha 2 beta 2, if you have no beta globin chains at all, then you will not form any kind of hemoglobin A. Okay, now next question says aplastic crisis in a patient with a history of beta thal major. The thing I'm thinking about here is parvo B19 Okay, remember, in patients that have these hemoglobinopathies, PARVO-B19, remember, it preferentially infects erythroid precursors. So these kids are at increased risk of aplastic crises with this single-stranded DNA bug. Okay, remember the association with a slapped cheek rash. Okay, now, elevated ferritin and decreased TIBC in a patient with a chronic history of beta thal major. Right, so if you have beta thal major, you're constantly hemolyzing your red blood cells. At some point, you become transfusion dependent. And the thing is, when you're transfusing blood, you're helping the patient, but in addition, you're giving them a ton of iron, okay? And that the body has very few means of getting rid of iron. In fact, the way the body regulates how much iron is in the blood at any given point in time, or the total body iron stores, if you may, is by regulating the reabsorption of iron in the GI tract. So if you're just giving a person iron, like IV, for example, and you're bypassing that system, you can begin to see how the person can have a lot of iron buildup and get secondary hemochromatosis. That is why the ferritin will be elevated. And if your ferritin is high, remember there is an inverse relationship between ferritin and TIBC. If the ferritin is high, the TIBC goes down. Okay, and remember, in hemochromatosis, women tend to get symptoms much later in life because menstruation is essentially a very effective means of getting rid of extra iron in the body. Okay, now, the classically tested vitamin replacement with the hemoglobinopathies is a replacement of folate, okay, because those people have like very huge amounts of red cell turnover and they're always making red cells all the time. They need something that will help with DNA synthesis, right? So remember that folate is important in the conversion of deoxyuridine monophosphate to deoxythymidine monophosphate under the action of thymidylate synthase. Thymidylate synthase uses the reduced form of folate, tetrahydrofolate, as a cofactor. So something to keep in mind. And if a person has beta thal major, they'll basically have hemolysis of their red cells. So they will have the kinds of labs you see in a person that has a hemolytic anemia, if you may, right? So they will have like decreased haptoglobin, because remember, haptoglobin binds up heme. They will also have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, because by breaking down those red cells, that heme is ultimately converted by the action of heme oxygenase and biliverdin reductase to indirect bilirubin, okay? So just something to keep in mind. And the combined hemoglobinopathies, I'll just say this in the context of sickle cell disease. If you have hemoglobin SS, where you have like sickle cell disease, you have very severe disease. But if you have hemoglobin S and some other kind of hemoglobinopathy, like hemoglobin C disease, for example, or hemoglobin one of these thalassemias, for example, on your other beta globin gene chain, you tend to have, it's usually still severe, but it's not as severe as having like hemoglobin SS. So just something to keep in mind with that as well. Now, slide number 2, a patient with a history of a malignancy involving a 15-17 translocation begins to bleed severely after surgery. PT, PTT, and D-dimer are all markedly elevated. What's your diagnosis? The first thing we need to consider here is this person has a 15-17 translocation, right? So this is most likely a hematologic malignancy, in this case AML, okay? Acute myeloid leukemia. And you can even be more specific and say that this is the M3 subtype according to the old classification system. This is an acute promyelocytic leukemia. And when you have an acute promyelocytic leukemia, the classic histologic finding is that thing known as an hour rod. So if the person is getting surgery for this leukemia, or they are getting chemotherapy, if those hour rods are released into circulation, those hour rods can actually activate and trigger the coagulation cascade. So these people can basically have a DIC picture. Okay, and in DIC, the way I think of the labs is you're just globally screwed. So what do I mean by being globally screwed? Your PT, anything that can go out of whack, goes out of whack, right? So your PT goes up, your PTT goes up, your D-dimer goes up, your bleeding time goes up, your platelet count goes down. And the reasoning behind that is, if you are constantly activating the coagulation cascade, the first thing you do is you're depleting your clotting factors, so you have an increased risk of bleeding. But the thing is, the coagulation cascade is known as secondary hemostasis. What do you need for secondary hemostasis to occur? Primary hemostasis. Okay, so if you're constantly depleting your clotting factors, I sort of imagine that, oh, you're also constantly activating primary hemostasis and you're depleting your platelets. So you get a thrombocytopenia. Okay, and in addition to that, your bleeding time goes up because your platelet count is going down. Okay, and again, by losing all your clotting factors, you have an increased risk of bleeding, but all those clotting factors that you've depleted have formed clots all over the body. And those clots, those are thrombi. One thing they can do is they can shear red cells that are passing through the vasculature. So you could potentially observe schistocytes on a blood smear, right? So that would be an example of an intravascular hemolysis. So just something to keep in mind with that. So that's the pathophysiology. And again, your platelet count will be low. You'll find schistocytes on a blood smear. Other classic causes include like HELLP syndrome. HELLP syndrome can present in a DIC-like picture. Let's see, what else? Amniotic fluid embolism can present in a DIC picture. If a person is septic from a severe infection, it can present in a DIC picture as well. Okay? And if you want to differentiate between von Willebrand's disease and hemophilia A, B, and C, the thing is, hemophilia A is a deficiency of factor 8, right? So the mnemonic you'll learn as you're studying for step 1 is that hemophilia A sounds like 8, right? So hemophilia A sounds like 8. And then hemophilia B, like B9, right? So hemophilia B is a deficiency of factor 9. And then hemophilia C is a deficiency of factor 11, okay? And the first two hemophilias, right? So hemophilias A and B, inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion, so it should only be boys that should have that on your test. Hemophilia C is passed on in an autosomal recessive fashion, right? So boys and girls can have hemophilia C on your exam. Now, how do you distinguish between this and von Willebrand's disease, which is a deficiency of von Willebrand factor? The thing is, those hemophilias, right, so factors 8, 9, and 11, are all involved in the intrinsic coagulation cascade. Okay, they have no part in the extrinsic coagulation cascade. So the only thing that will go up is your PTT. There will be no change in your PT. Okay, but if a person has von Willebrand's disease, if you have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor, your platelet count should be normal because it's not a quantitative platelet problem, but your bleeding time will be elevated because your platelets are not working so well. In addition to that, von Willebrand's factor, in addition to its role in primary hemostasis, which is where it basically serves as the officiating minister between subendothelial collagen and GP1B, it also acts as a protecting group for factor 8. So it increases the half-life of factor 8. So if you have a deficiency of von Willebrand's factor, factor 8 has a reduced half-life. And if it has that reduced half-life, your PTT will go up because you sort of have some problems with your intrinsic coagulation cascade, okay? So your PTT and your bleeding time are up in von Willebrand's disease, but in all the hemophilias, the only thing that will go up is your PTT. Now, in the hemophilias, right? So hemophilias are clotting factor deficits. When you have clotting factor problems, you tend to get more delayed but very severe bleeds. Okay, the classic bleeding pattern on the exam is a hemarthrosis, right? So you're bleeding into your joints, okay, or bleeding into muscle beds, for example. But if you have bleeds from platelet problems, you tend to get more superficial bleeds, right? So like petechiae, or bleeding after a dental procedure, or heavy menorrhagia and stuff like that. Okay, so those are things to think about. And the bleeds for platelet bleeds are more acute; they are more immediate, as against the clotting factor bleeds that are usually more delayed. And another thing to keep in mind, so you may wonder, like, why do you have superficial bleeds with platelet problems? The reasoning is, at least if I'm remembering this correctly, it appears that platelets secrete certain cytokines that maintain adherence junctions between epithelial cells. So if your platelet counts are down and You're not making those fancy cytokines that maintain adherence junctions between epithelial cells, then your epithelial cells will not be able to stick together very well, and you can begin to have like migration of blood across those cells, if you may. So you may have like petechiae. Okay, so that's one potential pathophysiology, but I probably wouldn't worry super much about that for the board exams. Okay, now the histocytin cofactor assay, right? So basically, this is a test of platelet adhesion. Okay, remember, platelet adhesion involves the binding of GP1B to subendothelial collagen by using von Willebrand's factor as a go-between. Okay, so if you have any problems in any of that, you would have an abnormal histocytin cofactor assay, because histocytin's job is to encourage that tripartite relationship between subendothelial collagen, von Willebrand's factor, and GP1B. So von Willebrand's disease, because you have a deficiency of von Willebrand's factor, will be associated with an abnormal histocytin cofactor assay. Bernard-Soulier syndrome disease, where you have a deficiency of GP1B, will also be associated with an abnormal histocytin cofactor assay. And how do you treat von Willebrand's disease? You actually treat this disease by giving at least the mild form. I think it's like the type A form of von Willebrand's disease. You give that by giving desmopressin, okay? Desmopressin increases the release of von Willebrand factor from ribopalladi bodies, okay, that you find in endothelial cells, okay? So by increasing the release of that stored von Willebrand factor, if you may, you can sort of relieve the symptoms of von Willebrand's disease. And just as an aside, remember that in platelets actually also contain von Willebrand's factor, but you find that von Willebrand's factor in alpha granules, not dense granules. Dense granules are the things that contain ADP. The alpha granules are the things that contain von Willebrand factor. Okay, so next slide, slide 3. So Reed-Sternberg cells on light microscopic observation of material obtained from a lymph node biopsy. So what am I talking about here? I hope you're thinking of Hodgkin's lymphoma, okay? So remember those cells that, the Reed-Sternberg cells are like cells that look like glasses. And they look like, basically it's like a bilateral owl's eye inclusion in a B cell. And what are the types of Hodgkin's lymphoma? So there are four types, I guess, that you need to worry about for exams. There is, and the easy way to remember is just remember that there's like, oh, the lymphocyte issues, and then there's the mixture issues, and then there's the nodular sclerosing type. So why do I break them down that way? The thing is, the best prognosis, Hodgkin's lymphoma, is the lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma. The worst prognosis, Hodgkin's lymphoma, is the lymphocyte depleted Hodgkin's lymphoma. Okay. And then in the middle, you have one known as the mixed cellularity one. Okay. That's the one that comes right before the lymphocyte depleted Hodgkin's lymphoma like if you're ranking by bad prognoses. And then the nodular sclerosing one is the one that comes right after the lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma in terms of prognosis. So from best to worst prognosis, we have lymphocyte predominant, nodular sclerosing, which is actually the most common kind of Hodgkin's lymphoma, mixed cellularity, and lymphocyte depleted. And the classic CD markers in Hodgkin's lymphoma are CD15 and CD30. Okay, although there is a kind of lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma where you don't have that CD30 positivity, but that's like super low yield for the boards. Now, what is the one general rule that relates to prognosis? I will say the one general rule is the more Reed-Sternberg cells you have, and the less lymphocytes you have, and the more extra like weird cells that you have in Hodgkin's lymphoma, the worse your prognosis, right? So, and again, that should sort of make sense if you're thinking of all these immune therapies that have come on board recently. By encouraging your immune system to do its job, you have a better prognosis in many cancers. So, less lymphocytes, so fewer lymphocytes, more Reed-Sternberg cells, and more other cells besides lymphocytes, portend a bad prognosis in Hodgkin's lymphoma. And one way that your friends at the MBME could test Hodgkin's lymphoma in the context of biostatistics is to remind you that there's a bimodal distribution of Hodgkin's lymphoma, right? So it shows up in young adults and then shows up in the older population. So that's something to keep in mind. Another classic way they test that relationship is if you're comparing fast and slow acetylators, say for example with isoniazid exposure. Remember, that's part of the reason why you get drug-induced lupus with your antihistone antibodies and with isoniazid use, okay? So there's a bimodal distribution. There's slow acetylators and there's fast acetylators. So something to keep in mind. Now, the bug that's classically associated with Hodgkin's lymphoma and many other hematologic malignancies is the Epstein-Barr virus, okay? Remember, the Epstein-Barr virus is herpes 4. Okay, so next slide, discussion of primary hemostasis plus some quick pulmonary farm association. Okay, so basically primary hemostasis has four parts. Okay, the first part is, let's assume you get hacked by some annoying medical school classmate, okay, and you begin to bleed. The first thing your body says is, so you don't bleed, what's the quickest way I can sort of tamponade that bleed, if you may? The quickest way for your body to fix that problem is to vasoconstrict the vessels that are feeding that bleed, okay? And your body actually uses endothelin to make that happen. Now, this is where the pulmonary farm association comes in. That endothelin, if we know that endothelin is a powerful vasoconstrictor, it should make sense that blocking endothelin receptors should promote vasodilation. In fact, endothelin receptor antagonists like ambrisentan, which blocks endothelin A receptors only, and bosentan, which blocks endothelin A and B receptors, they're used to treat pulmonary hypertension. So remember, if you have like a lady that's in her 30s that presents with dyspnea and chronic hypoxia, and they tell you that, oh, she has like right heart failure symptoms, think about pulmonary arterial hypertension, secondary to like a BMPR2 mutation, okay? So vasoconstriction is the first step. The next step is by hacking those blood vessels, right, you expose subendothelial collagen. That subendothelial collagen can bind to something known as von Willebrand's factor. Okay, von Willebrand's factor has two sources. It can come from the alpha granules of platelets, or it can come from the Weibo-Palladi buddies of endothelial cells. And while we're on the subject of buddies, I'll just take a small quick detour, right? So we said Weibo-Palladi buddies, they contain von Willebrand's factor. You find them in endothelial cells. Two classically tested structural things that you find in different cell types on step one are, one, I remember your lamella buddies in your type 2 pneumocytes. Those lamella buddies are basically the storage forms of surfactant. So something to keep in mind. Next one is your Birbeck granules that you'll find with pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis. Okay. Remember, that's like S100 and CD1A positive. So those are just things to keep in mind. Okay. So back to this, right? So subendothelial collagen binds to von Willebrand's factor. And von Willebrand's factor then binds to GP1B. So von Willebrand's factor is a go-between between subendothelial collagen, which you find below endothelial cells, and GP1B, which you find on the surface of platelets. So that's the adhesion step of primary hemostasis. When that process happens, your platelets begin to release some stuff, okay? One thing they release is, real quick. Just some quick tie-ins. If you have a deficiency of GP1B, right, that's Bernard-Soulier disease, okay? If you have a deficiency of von Willebrand's factor, that's von Willebrand's disease, right? So, continuing, right? So, we've talked about the adhesion step. Now, we said after that adhesion step happens, your platelets begin to release a bunch of random stuff, right? So, like thromboxane A2. Thromboxane A2 is a promoter of the next two steps of primary hemostasis, which are activation and aggregation. Okay, so if you're an antiplatelet drug, you'd potentially want to decrease the synthesis of thromboxane A2. And it so happens that thromboxane A2 is made by cyclooxygenase, COX-1 and 2. So if you inhibited cyclooxygenase irreversibly with a drug like aspirin, okay, you could decrease the synthesis of thromboxane A2. And when you decrease TXA2 synthesis, you prevent platelet aggregation and platelet activation. Now, another thing that's released by platelets is ADP, okay? That ADP can come and bind to the ADP receptor. The ADP receptor is a G, so that's a kind of, I guess, a autocrine regulation, right? Because the platelet is releasing something that acts on a receptor found on the surface of platelets. So that ADP, it binds to the ADP receptor. And when you have that binding, that ADP receptor is actually GI coupled, okay? So by being GI coupled, it's a G protein coupled receptor. It inhibits the activity of adenylate cyclase, so you convert less ATP to cyclic AMP, okay? And those low levels of cyclic AMP are coupled to the expression of GP2B3A on the surface of a platelet, okay? That expression of GP2B3A is the sort of triggers the aggregation step of primary hemostasis. But this whole business I've described with ADP binding to the ADP receptor and reducing the levels of cyclic AMP within the platelet, that's the activation step of primary hemostasis, okay? And then that GP2B3A basically binds to fibrinogen, which is also known as factor 1, okay? And that fibrinogen, so it's like, think of fibrinogen as having like two ends, okay? If one end binds GP2B3A from one platelet, the other end binds another GP2B3A from another platelet, then you have the aggregation step of primary hemostasis. You've sort of formed a platelet, the temporary platelet plug, okay? Now, some pathology and some pharmacology with that is, one, we have antiplatelet drugs that can inhibit the platelet activation step, okay? And if you notice, I'm being very specific with these, like, steps. The reason why I'm being specific is these board exams have been known to talk about a drug and ask what's the step of primary hemostasis that is inhibited, okay? So it's the activation step that can be inhibited by a drug that blocks the ADP receptor. This ADP receptor is also known as the P2Y12 receptor, okay? And if you block that receptor, you will sort of shut down that signaling cascade that leads to platelet activation. And drugs like clopidogrel, right? So it's an irreversible ADP receptor blocker, or drugs like prasugrel or ticlopidine or ticagrelor, those are all ADP receptor antagonists. Okay, remember, ticlopidine actually has an association with thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura. We'll talk about those platelet drugs in another podcast. Now, another pharmacology tie-in, right? So we said high cyclic AMP equals low cyclic AMP makes a platelet activated. So high cyclic AMP should make a platelet inactivated, okay? And it so happens that the enzyme that breaks down cyclic AMP is phosphodiesterase, okay? For purposes of our discussion, let's zoom in on phosphodiesterase 3, okay? So if you inhibited phosphodiesterase 3, your cyclic AMP levels will build up and your platelets will not be activated. Okay, so that's how drugs like cilostazol and dipyridamole work. They prevent the breakdown of cyclic AMP, which acts to inhibit the activation of platelets. And just as an aside, cyclic AMP does two different things, right? So in cardiac muscle, cyclic AMP encourages cardiac muscle contraction. But in smooth muscle, elevated levels of cyclic AMP actually promote relaxation. Okay, so that is why a drug like cilostazol is actually used to treat peripheral arterial disease, because by inhibiting phosphodiesterase and boosting your cyclic AMP levels, you have a relaxation of smooth muscle, so you have better perfusion of the stenosed vessels that line your legs. Okay, now another tie in here is that we have drugs that can also block the GP2B3 receptor, right? So these drugs, they're inhibiting the aggregation step of primary hemostasis, right? So drugs like apsiximab, which is a monoclonal antibody, and small molecules like eptifibatide and tirofiban work by blocking the GP2B3 receptor. You could alternatively make autoantibodies against the GP2B3 receptor in a disease known as ITP, okay? Immune thrombocytopenic purpura. And remember that that disease has a very strong association with systemic lupus. Okay, so something to keep in mind. Now, I've talked about the risdiplam cofactor assay, right? So it will obviously be abnormal in von Willebrand's disease and Bernard-Soulier syndrome. Okay, I've talked about the two high yield sources of von Willebrand's factor. Okay, the alpha granules of platelets and the WIBO Palladi buddies of endothelial cells. And to increase the release of von Willebrand's factor, we've talked about how you give desmopressin for that. Okay, because again, it increases the release of von Willebrand's factor from WIBO Palladi buddies. And you may say, oh man, how does this make any sense? Well, let me give you a teleologic explanation. Okay, the thing is, ADH, its job is to maintain your blood volume. If you're bleeding, your blood volume will not be maintained, right? So if you clot off bleeding, you stop losing blood volume. So it should make sense that a hormone, ADH in this case, that tries to maintain blood volume should promote the activity of something that causes clotting. Okay, so just something to keep in mind with that. Now, two high yield activators of platelets, thromboxane A2 is a powerful platelet activator. Another high yield platelet activator is thrombin factor 2. Factor 2 actually activates platelets as well. Okay, let's see. And then a high yielding activator of platelet activation or aggregation, that'll be PGI2. Okay, PGI2. So PGI2, just remember it as a platelet gathering inhibitor, if you may. PGI2 analogs are actually used to also treat pulmonary arterial hypertension because they are also very nice vasodilators. So remember your drugs like treprostinil or epoprostenol or iloprost. Those are all PGI2 analogs that are used to treat pulmonary arterial hypertension because they raise the levels of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle. Okay, and I will have to look this up, so don't quote me on this, but I think PGI2 actually acts on, actually works through either G, actually I think it's a GS coupled, G protein coupled receptor, right? So if again, if you act through GS, your cyclic AMP levels will go up, okay? And that sort of explains how these drugs could act as good vasodilators, because remember I said that high levels of cyclic AMP cause smooth muscle relaxation. In fact, just give me like a quick 30 second break. Let me just check on this PGI2 business. So PGI2 receptor. Okay. It acts through GS coupled receptors. Perfect. Good. So let's go ahead and move on to slide 5. Okay. So categorizing anemias, right? So anemias, basically, there's three kinds of anemias, right? So as our friend Uncle Pathoma would say, there's microcytic anemias where your MCV is less than 80. There's normocytic anemias where your MCV is between 80 to 100. And then there's macrocytic anemias where your MCV is greater than 100. Okay. The classic causes of microcytic anemias include things like thalassemias or anemia of chronic disease or lead poisoning or sideroblastic anemia. And I guess there's a few other causes. We can talk about that later. For your normocytic anemias, mainly think about your hemolytic anemias. So problems where you have like either autoantibodies being formed against your red cells, or you have like a structural red cell deficit like hereditary spherocytosis or elliptocytosis, or you have an enzyme deficit like a G6PD deficiency or pyruvate kinase deficiency. Okay. And then your macrocytic anemias, think of those in the context of either liver disease or B12 or folate deficiency, okay? And the next part says 50-year-old male presenting with iron deficiency anemia. The thing I really want you to think about here is colon cancer, okay? The next step in management for that patient will be a colonoscopy because colonic malignancies can bleed chronically and present as an iron deficiency anemia, classically in people that are more than 50 years old. Now, the pathophysiology of microcytosis, right? So I sort of think of it this way. Red cells, they try to maintain a very specific hemoglobin concentration, okay? They try to keep their hemoglobin concentration within like a good range, if you may, okay? And remember, from general chemistry in college, concentration is mass over volume, okay? So if you have very low levels of hemoglobin, okay, because you have, remember, hemoglobin contains iron. So if you have like low levels of hemoglobin, the mass, right? So the numerator in that concentration measure goes down. So the way you can keep that concentration constant, if the mass is going down or the numerator is going down, is by also decreasing the denominator, decreasing the MCV of your red cell. Okay, so that potentially explains the microcytosis you get in the microcytic anemias. But the thing is, there's a certain volume that your red cells can get to where gas exchange becomes like super inefficient and it's not worthwhile to shrink the red cell any further. Okay, so if you have like just this hemoglobin deficiency over long periods of time, you hit a certain small size of red cell where your blood is like, you know what, I can't shrink this red cell anymore. So let me then not look pretty as a red cell, okay? And then you begin to present with the hypochromasia that you get with hypochromic microcytic anemias. Now, for macrocytosis, the problem is you have a deficiency in stuff that helps with DNA synthesis, right? So if you have like a folate, which is vitamin B9 or a B12 deficiency, you can make DNA very well. And remember, when you're making DNA, right, you're usually making it for a cell to divide. So if a cell has increased in size first, but you're like, man, there is no DNA for me to add to these new big cell, new daughter cells, and beginning to form, you can sort of imagine that you stay as that one big cell that was ready to divide, so you get a macrocytosis. Okay, now next slide, differentiating four high yield but weird diseases. Okay, and for probably like two of these diseases, I'll discuss pathophysiology because that's also classically tested on these board exams. But let's go by vignette, right? So we'll have four patients. So patient A is a 7-month-old with very low red cell numbers. White blood cell and platelet counts are completely normal. The MCV is 107. Physical exam is notable for a cleft palate. So this patient has something called diamond Blackfan anemia. Okay, diamond Blackfan anemia. And in diamond Blackfan anemia, classically shows up in a kid that's less than a year old on exams. Okay, and the only thing that is usually abnormal are their red cell numbers. Their white cell numbers and their platelet numbers are usually just fine, okay? And usually these kids have a macrocytic anemia, okay? And they usually have like craniofacial defects, like a cleft lip or cleft palate, okay? And the pathophysiology here is people think that this involves problems with ribosomal proteins, okay? So something to keep in mind there. Now, patient B is a 2-year-old with a history of malabsorption and fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies. He's in the first percentile for height. His white cell count is low, with an especially low neutrophil count, but platelet and red cell counts are normal. He visits an orthopedic surgeon frequently for recurring skeletal problems. So this kid actually has something known as Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, right? So here's why they love to test this disorder, right? Because it's very easy to mix this up with diamond Blackfan, right? They both have diamond in the name, okay? But patient A, we said, had diamond Blackfan anemia. Patient B has Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. Shwachman, I believe, is spelled as S-H-W-A-C-H-M-A-N, okay? So Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. We said in diamond Blackfan, the problem was you had very low levels of red cells. In Shwachman-Diamond, you have very low levels of neutrophils, but classically on exams, your platelet counts and your red cell numbers are usually just fine. Okay, so what are the other findings in Shwachman-Diamond syndrome? Other findings include like a short stature, right? So like first percentile for height. They tend to have skeletal problems, right? That's why I talked about having to visit orthopedic surgeons all the time. Okay, and a very like a super high yield finding is pancreatic exocrine insufficiency. Okay, so remember, if your pancreas is not, if you're not squirting out those lipases, for example, you will not reabsorb your vitamins A, D, E, and K, your fat-soluble vitamins. Okay, so that's why the kid has like fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies, right? So like, if you don't have enough vitamin A, you have like visual problems. If you don't have a vitamin D, you can get like rickets, right? Remember, in rickets, you have a vitamin D deficiency, so you have a secondary hyperparathyroidism with that. Let's see, for vitamin E, you can have like bleeding problems. Also the same thing with vitamin K. Okay, so things to keep in mind. So that is Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. Now, patient C, pathophysiology doesn't really matter for that one. Now, patient C has a history of severe bleeding after dental procedures, recurrent infection with encapsulated organisms, and severe anemia, right? So this cluster tells you that they probably have problems with the entire blood cell line, right? So they're bleeding after dental procedures. They may have like platelet problems. They have recurrent infections. So they may have white cell problems, and they have severe anemia. So they may have red cell problems, okay? And here's the kicker. This kid has no thumbs on his left hand. I guess you can't have two thumbs on one hand. So let's change that to one thumb. So he has no thumb on his left hand. A radial bone is not palpable on physical exam. And this kid has café au lait spots, okay, which are visualized on the face and trunk. This is Fanconi anemia, okay? So please, please, please do not mistake Fanconi anemia for Fanconi syndrome. Fanconi syndrome is coming up soon. This kid has Fanconi anemia. And unlike Diamond-Blackfan anemia, where you just had predominantly a red cell problem, or Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, where you had primarily a white cell problem, more specifically neutrophils, in Fanconi anemia, you have problems with every cell. So you have like white cell, red cell, and platelet problems. Okay? Now, the pathophysiology here, classically, is a person that has problems fixing double-stranded DNA breaks. Okay? One of the ways you fix a double-stranded DNA break is with something called non-homologous end joining. So if you have problems in that process, okay, you will have like apoptosis and death of many of your blood cells, okay? So that's what you observe in Fanconi anemia. And the classic findings, café au lait spots, okay? So please do not think café au lait spots are just in neurofibromatosis. You can also get café au lait spots in Albright hereditary osteodystrophy, and you can, as you can see right now, get it in Fanconi anemia as well, okay? So if you see a kid with low levels of everything, okay, and they have problems with their thumbs, okay, problems with their radial bones, like the radius, think about Fanconi anemia. As a bonus for your peach shelf in the future, there is a disease known as thrombocytopenia absent radius syndrome, TAR syndrome. Basically, in that syndrome, those people have low levels of platelets, okay, and they have no radius. But unlike Fanconi anemia, they have no problems with their thumbs. Okay, but that's low yield for now. That's more for a pediatric shelf. Now, patient D has a history of a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. He also has a history of recurrent nephrolithiasis with urine microscopy revealing stone-shaped like benzene rings. There are high levels of multiple electrolytes in his urine. He has brittle bones. Okay, so this patient does not have Fanconi anemia. This patient has Fanconi syndrome. Okay, Fanconi syndrome, for your exam, think of it as presenting more with kidney problems. Okay, more specifically, think of it as presenting with proximal renal tubular problems. And we know that the proximal renal tubule is the workhorse of the nephron, right? So if you have like a global transporter deficit in the proximal convoluted tubule, you can begin to envision that a patient would have problems with reabsorbing many electrolytes. That's why you see multiple electrolytes in the urine, okay? And remember, if your proximal tubule is non-functional, okay, you have a type 2 renal tubular acidosis, okay? Remember, your RTAs are an example of the non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, okay? So this patient will have a type 2 RTA, okay? And remember, this is one of the RTAs that has an association with hypokalemia, but the urine pH is just fine. Okay, the urine pH is just fine. Remember, the only hyperkalemic RTA is a type 4 RTA, where you have low levels of aldosterone. Okay, now, Why does this patient have recurring nephral lithiasis and you see urine stones that are shaped like benzene rings? Remember that cysteine is reabsorbed in the proximal tubule. Okay, so if that cysteine transporter is not working, which is one of the findings in Fanconi's syndrome, okay, those cysteine stones will persist in the urine and cause nephrolithiasis. Okay, remember those cysteine stones, they have six sides. Okay, and good mnemonic there is a cysteine sounds like 16. Okay, so they have six sides. Remember, benzene rings have six sides, and they also have brittle bones because they're not reabsorbing phosphate. Okay, almost all of the phosphate that's reabsorbed in the nephron is reabsorbed at the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, remember the transporter that does that process is inhibited by the phosphate trashing hormone, PTH. Okay, so again, if you have a global transporter deficit and you're not reabsorbing phosphate, you can potentially have rickets as a kid, okay, or osteomalacia if you're an adult. And just as a corollary here, before I go to the next slide, I don't know if you guys remember the cola transporter deficit. If you have a deficiency, in fact, let's see, cola transporter, I believe that's Hartnup disease. So cola transporter, okay. So cola transporter deficit. Sorry, I'm a fourth year. Some of these things I'm beginning to forget them, unfortunately. Cola. 1 second. Okay. I think it's Hartnup's disease. Let's see. Hartnup disease. Okay. Oh, no. That's neutral amino acids. You know what? Let's call it cola transporter deficit. I'll have to find out more about that to see if the disease has an actual name. Okay. But that cola transporter deficit, remember the C in that cola, in cola stands for cysteine. Okay. So you can have cysteine stones in the urine. Okay, so you can get a cystinosis with that as well. Okay, so now we're done with that. So again, patient A had diamond black fan anemia. Patient B had Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. Patient C had Fanconi anemia. Patient D had Fanconi syndrome. Okay, these diseases present very similarly or have very similar names. So I said to sort of catalog everything for you on one slide. Okay, so question 7, discussion of secondary hemostasis. Ooh, okay. So a lot of factor names are going to be thrown around in short order, okay? And we'll talk about some pathologies associated with secondary hemostasis as well, and some pharmacology and the clot busters. Okay, so basically we have two pathways of secondary hemostasis, right? So the thing is, primary hemostasis helps you form a temporary platelet plug, but that platelet plug is not super ideal, okay? It's not super ideal, but it helps you as a temporary measure. You need something that's a little more permanent. And that more permanent thing is secondary hemostasis. And there are two pathways of secondary hemostasis. There's the intrinsic pathway that starts with factor 12, and that starts with the PTT. And then there's the extrinsic pathway that starts with factor 7, and that starts with the PT or the INR. Okay, so let's discuss the intrinsic pathway first. So basically in the intrinsic pathway, you start with factor 12, okay? Factor 12, you convert it to factor 12A, okay? Factor 12A then converts factor 11 to factor 11A, okay? Then factor 11A converts factor 9 to 9A, okay? And then factor 9A with the help of factor 8A helps you convert factor 10 to factor 10A, okay? Now, factor 10A helps you convert factor 2 to factor 2A. Factor 2 is also known as thrombin, okay? And it uses factor 5 as a helpmate in that process, okay? And then factor 2, when it's converted to 2A, right? That 2A converts factor 1, which is fibrinogen, right? Remember, that was the thing we said bound to GP2B3A, to factor 1A, which is fibrin, okay? And you form a stronger platelet mesh. And factor 13 actually helps. Factor 13 is sort of like on its own. It's not involved in the entire cascade. The only thing it sort of does is at the end, it comes and sort of stabilizes those fibrin meshes really well. Okay. So that's the intrinsic cascade. The extrinsic cascade is much simpler. Starts with factor 7, okay? And usually tissue factor is the activator of that process. Tissue factor is actually known as factor 3. So factor 7 is converted to 7A, and then 7A also helps with converting factor 10 to 10A, okay? And then 10A, like we said, uses factor 5 to convert 2 to 2A, and 2A converts factor 1 to 1A, and then factor 13 stabilizes that fibrin mesh, okay? So that is the basic part of a secondary hemostasis. But let's talk about some associated physiological concepts. First thing is factor 2, okay? Factor 2 has many tasks that it plays, okay? One role it plays is it activates the accelerating factors of secondary hemostasis, right? So the accelerating factors are the things that I said that, oh, they serve as helpmates for other clotting factors to make stuff happen, right? So we said, for example, if you were going from factors 10 to 10A, factor 9A could do that with the help of factor 8A. Factor 8A is an accelerating factor, okay? And we said in the conversion of factor 2 to 2A by factor 10A, factor 10A co-opted a helpmate, factor 5A, to help with that process. So to actually make factor 8A from factor 8 and factor 5A from factor 5, you do need factor 2 to make that process happen, okay? Another high yield thing that's done by factor 2, thrombin, right, is that, again, it converts factor 1 to 1A. And then another high yield function is that factor 2 also binds to something known as thrombomodulin, okay, to help you convert protein C to something known as activated protein C, okay? Activated protein C is useful in the sense that it combines with its cofactor, factor S, to inhibit factors 5 and 8, okay? To inhibit factors 5 and 8, okay? So, easy way to remember that is factor 2 helps you activate factors 8 and factor 5, okay? But factor 2 can also bind, pair up with a buddy, thrombomodulin, to make something, activated protein C, that joins up with the cofactor protein S, to help you make, to help you inactivate the active forms of factors 8 and 5, okay? Now, antithrombin 3 is something that helps you inactivate factors 10 and factor 2, okay? Remember, antithrombin 3 is super activated by heparin, right, to inactivate that factors, factor 10 and 2, okay? Contrast that with low molecular weight heparin that activates antithrombin 3 to help you inactivate just factor 10, okay? That's why if a person takes a heparin, you follow them with a PTT. But if a person takes low molecular weight heparin where you're just inhibiting factor 10, you do a factor 10 assay to follow those levels. Okay, now, warfarin. Warfarin is an inhibitor of something known as vitamin K epoxide. Well, who cares about that? Well, let me show you why you should care. The thing is, factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, and protein C and S, as produced by the liver, are not active, okay? To become active, you need to gamma carboxylate these clotting factors, okay, and these proteins. So the thing that helps you gamma carboxylate those factors is the reduced form of vitamin K, okay? So vitamin K does the reaction, you gamma carboxylate those fancy things, and you're good to go, okay? But in that reaction, vitamin K is converted from the reduced form back to its oxidized form. Okay, so if you want that reaction that you love to keep going, you need to keep vitamin K in the reduced state. Okay, keeping vitamin K in the reduced state is done by an enzyme known as vitamin K epoxide reductase. Okay, that enzyme is inhibited by warfarin. Okay, so that is why if a person is taking a warfarin, you get the anticoagulant effect because you are not making the active forms of factors 2, 7, 9, and 10. Okay. And then your clot busters, because if you've made the fibrin mesh, you also don't want to keep a fibrin mesh forever, okay? That's not ideal, because you could potentially have like ischemia of an organ, which is, again, not good. So your body actually has a system in place to break down fibrin to fibrin degradation products. That role is undertaken by plasmin, okay? Plasmin is an active protein. The zymogen form of plasmin is plasminogen. Okay, and the conversion of plasminogen to plasmin can be done by something known as a TPA. Okay, so TPA is a clot busting drug. So like alteplase, reteplase, tenecteplase, they work by helping you convert plasminogen to plasmin, and then that plasmin can go ahead and lyse fibrin. Okay, now some pathology. Again, we said if you have a factor 8 deficiency, that's hemophilia A. Factor 9 deficiency, we'll say that's hemophilia B. Factor 11 deficiency, we'll say that's hemophilia C. Remember, hemophilia A and B are inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion, but hemophilia C is inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. So it can show up in boys and girls. So if you see a girl hemophilia on your USMLE exams, think about hemophilia C, not hemophilia A or B. Okay, now, again, your PTT will be elevated in hemophilias A, B, and C because those are part of those deficient factors 8, 9, and 11 are all a part of the intrinsic coagulation cascade. Your PTT will be normal, okay? But in von Willebrand's disease, we said your bleeding time will be up and your PTT will be up because von Willebrand's factor acts as a protecting group for factor 8. So if you ever take any exam in the future and the bleeding time is elevated, the platelet count is normal, and the PTT is up, you should have a very, very good reason for not picking von Willebrand's disease. Okay, now, this is kind of a unique question. What is the clotting factor deficiency that has no effect on the measured PT and PTT value? Well, if you follow the long, when we're talking about the cascade, remember we said that there was this clotting factor that was sort of off to the side that just only came to stabilize the fibrin mesh. That's factor 13. Okay, a factor 13 deficiency will not present with elevations in PT or PTT. Okay, and protein C and S, we've talked about what they do. They inactivate factors 8 and 5. Factor 2, I've talked about all its special roles. Factor 5, Leiden, right? It's a problem where you have resistance of factor 5 to degradation by protein C. Okay, so if factor 5 has a longer half-life, you could potentially imagine that you have more risk of forming clots, right? So factor 5 Leiden is a hypercoagulable disorder. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, this is probably the most common hypercoagulable disorder in the entire world. Okay, now a G20210A mutation, basically this is a problem where you're making too much factor 2. Okay, if you're making too much factor 2, you're making more, you potentially form more clots. So that's also a hypercoagulable disorder. Okay, antithrombin 3 deficiency is also a hypercoagulable disorder because by having that deficiency of antithrombin 3, you do not inactivate factors 10 and 2. Okay, so you have an increased risk of forming clots. Okay, remember, people that have an AT3 deficiency, they will potentially have a very minimal response to heparin administration, right? Because they have no AT3 around. Or they may require a larger than normal administration of heparin to get any kind of antithrombin 3 response. And also remember that antithrombin 3 is part of what is lost in the urine in nephrotic syndrome. That's why you could potentially, a person could potentially get like thrombotic events in nephrotic syndrome, like renal vein thrombosis, for example. Okay, so next slide. The differential diagnosis of eosinophilia, right? So remember, there's an NAACP mnemonic or DNAACP mnemonic or CANADA-P mnemonic. So whichever one floats your boat, but let's use DNAACP. Okay, so the D is for drugs. Okay, the N is for neoplasms. Okay, there are certain cancers, especially hematologic cancers like the Hodgkin's lymphomas that could actually present with eosinophilia. Because some of those, like the Reed-Sternberg cell every now and then produces interleukin 5, so that can encourage differentiation of eosinophils. Okay, the first A can stand for like allergies or atopic diseases or asthma. The other A can stand for acute interstitial nephritis. Okay, the third A can stand for Addison's disease. Remember, that's an autoimmune destruction of the adrenal cortex. And then the C can stand for collagen vascular disease, right? So like Churg-Strauss syndrome, although it's no longer called Churg-Strauss, it's now called eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? So if a person has they have like nephritic syndrome, they have asthma, and you find granulomas on like a lung biopsy or a kidney biopsy, think about a Church-Strauss syndrome. They classically have elevated eosinophils in the serum, and then the P stands for parasites. Okay, and two things I want to draw from this is, one, you have a proliferation of eosinophils in the setting of parasitic or helminthic infection. Okay, and remember, the primary thing your eosinophils use to nuke those nasty buggers is a major basic protein. It's just one of those things you want to know for step one. Another thing with that is, we said that Addison's disease, which is a low cortisol state, is associated with eosinophilia. So it should thus make sense that a high cortisol state, so let's assume you're taking glucocorticoids for some autoimmune disease, or you have some kind of Cushing syndrome, should be actually associated with a low eosinophil state. Okay, so high cortisol equals low eosinophils. Okay, low cortisol equals high eosinophils. So just something to keep in mind. Now, pharmacological management of cell type with dense blue granules that obfuscates the nucleus. That's basophilia, right? That's those are your basophils, okay? And basophilia is classically associated with CML. Okay, remember CML with your 922 translocation, where you make the BCR able tyrosine kinase receptor, also called the 922 translocation. It's like the Philadelphia chromosome business, and you could treat that by giving imatinib. Okay, which is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Okay, now, pharmacological management of CGD and osteopetrosis, right? So remember, CGD is a deficiency of NADPH oxidase. Okay, so if you have an NADPH oxidase deficiency, your respiratory burst does not work. So you have an increased risk of recurrent infections with catalase positive bugs. Okay, so it's a oxidative burst problem. Okay, which is a very important pathway in macrophages. Okay. Osteopetrosis is also a macrophage problem, but the macrophage that we're concerned about here is the osteoclast. Okay, remember, osteoclasts help you resorb bone, and they resorb bone by basically like building a wall known as a ruffled border. Okay, and then they secrete a ton of acid across that ruffled border, and that acid helps you resorb bone. Okay, and one of the key enzymes in that process is carbonic anhydrase 2. So if you have a deficiency of carbonic anhydrase 2, you do not have your osteoclast secreting acid into the ruffled border. So you have predominant activity of osteoblasts, okay? And that's how you get brittle bone disease, osteopetrosis, okay? So why am I asking about these two things and asking about the pharmacological management? I'm trying to draw a parallel that these are primarily macrophage problems. And to treat these macrophage problems, we can give something that potentially stimulates macrophages, right? So think of this thing as the anabolic steroid for macrophages. That's interferon gamma. Okay, interferon gamma is actually used to manage CGD and osteopetrosis. And just real quick, while we're on the topic of macrophages, let's just quickly run through high yield macrophages, right? So in the lungs, we have the alveolar macrophages, right? Some pathologists call them dust cells. If you go to the liver, right, we have a Kupffer cells with those. If you go to the placenta, right, we have the Hofbauer cells. You're trying to protect the baby against infection. If you go to bone, right, we have osteoclasts, well, like we already mentioned. If you go to the kidneys, okay, we have the mesangial cells. Remember, the mesangial cells form part of the glomerular matrix, and they also form part of the extraglomerular apparatus. The juxtaglomerular apparatus. And then, those are the ones that come to mind right now. Okay, so next question, question 9. A 23-year-old female with no prenatal care delivers a stillborn hydropic fetus. This is her second pregnancy. Ding, ding, ding. Her first pregnancy was without complication. What is the hematologic diagnosis? So hopefully you are thinking about RH incompatibility. Okay. So this lady is more than likely RH negative. Okay. And her first pregnancy was probably with an RHD positive baby. Okay. So, and for that pregnancy to have had an RHD positive baby, that means she potentially had an RHD positive husband. Okay, so When she saw that RhD positive fetus, her body decided to make antibodies against the D antigen. Okay, so on the next, and the first fetus, no problem. Okay, good delivery. But on the next pregnancy, those autoantibodies against the D antigen can cross the placenta. Okay, remember IgG is what will actually do this, right? Not IgM. IgG is the only immunoglobulin that crosses the placenta. So that IgG crosses the placenta, goes, and basically causes an extravascular destruction of the baby's red cells. Okay, so if the baby has that severe anemia, their cardiac output will have to chronically be increased. They can go into high output heart failure, and that can cause like fluid buildup across the body. Okay, so they can be born with hydrops fetalis. Okay, so that's Rh incompatibility. Now, the blood groups. So we have many blood types, right? So there's like blood group A, there's blood group B, there's blood group AB, there's blood group O, there's a weird kind of blood group O that's called the Bombay phenotype. Okay, so basically these questions relating to blood groups on exams, they're usually head scratchers for some people. So let's sort of talk through this. So the thing is, let's see, how do I discuss this? If a person has the A antigen on their red cells, they have blood group A. Okay, if you have blood group A, then you form autoantibodies against things that are foreign, okay, like the B antigen. Okay, so people that have blood group A have anti-B antibodies. Okay, and those people can only accept blood from people that are type A, okay, and people that are type O. And the reasoning behind that is type O blood has no A or B antigen. So there's nothing on the type O blood that can be attacked by the anti-B antibodies that type A patients have. In addition, they can get type A blood because, again, they don't have autoantibodies against the A antigen. They cannot get type B blood because they have autoantibodies against the B antigen. Okay? Now, for a patient that has type B blood, right, so they have the B antigen on the surface of their red cells, so those patients will form anti-A antibodies because they don't have the A antigen on their red cells. And these patients can only receive type B blood, again, because they have no anti-B antibodies. They can also receive type O blood because, again, type O blood has no A or B antigen that can be attacked by the anti-A antibodies. But these patients cannot receive type A blood because they have anti-A antibodies, and you can get an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction with that. Now, a patient that has type O blood has no A or B antigen, okay? So if they have no, I guess before I jump to type O, let me talk about type AB, okay? If you have type AB blood, you have type A and type B antigen, okay? So a patient that has both does not form any antibodies against type A, does not have anti-A antibodies or anti-B antibodies. So they essentially have no antibodies in their serum. So these patients are very good at accepting blood from everybody because they have no autoantibodies to attack anything. So they can get type A blood, they can get type B blood, they can get type AB blood, they can get type O blood even. Okay? So these people that have a type AB phenotype are universal recipients. Okay, now if you jump to a person that has type O blood, a person that has type O blood has no A antigen or B antigen. So because they have no A antigen or B antigen, they form anti-A and anti-B antibodies. So these people cannot receive type A blood because you have hemolysis. They cannot receive type B blood because you have hemolysis. They also cannot receive type AB blood because they have antibodies against the A and B antigen. The only thing they can receive is type O blood. Okay, they can receive only type O blood. Because again, type O blood has nothing that can be attacked by the anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Now, the Bombay phenotype, basically, it's a kind of type O blood that is missing. Let me just simplify it this way for you. It's missing the A antigen, it's missing the B antigen, It's missing the thing that makes type O blood type O blood. Okay, that's why I said that the Bombay phenotype is a type O blood subset. Okay, the thing it actually misses is something called the H antigen. Okay, but let's sort of leave it at that. Okay, so let's just assume that the Bombay phenotype, you have a deficiency of the thing that makes type O blood type O. So these patients, they form antibodies against the A antigen, against the B antigen, and against the thing that makes type O blood type O. Okay, so if they have anti-A, anti-B, and anti-make me look like type O blood antibodies, you can then reason that these patients with the Bombay phenotype cannot accept type A blood, type B blood, type AB blood, or type O blood. Okay, they can only get blood from another person that has the Bombay phenotype, which is extremely unfortunate. Okay, so I have basically talked about all the stuff on this slide. And remember, people with type O blood are universal donors, right? Because, again, their red cells have no antigens on them. So there's nothing that can be, there's nothing that, there, whatever other antibody you have in your serum won't do anything to the type O blood. Although remember that people with the Bombay phenotype can get hemolytic reactions if they get type O blood. Okay, that'll be a very unique exception that your board exams would potentially want to test. Okay, so the final slide. So a patient with a past medical history of a Miller rash and positive ANA antibodies presents with a 2-week history of fatigue, dyspnea, and jaundice. Okay, fatigue, dyspnea, and jaundice. Haptoglobin and hematocrit levels are decreased. Indirect bilirubin and urine urobilinogen are increased. There is no increase in urine bilirubin. So what's the diagnosis? Okay, so this is hemolytic anemia. Okay, and given this patient's history of lupus, they potentially have an autoimmune hemolytic anemia. And for this, we'll need to do a Coombs test, a direct Coombs test. Before we talk about the Coombs test, let me sort of sort out for these like weird findings from the early part of the question. Because, again, it's a very nice way for them to test biochem on the exam. Or I guess metabolism, if you may. So, this patient has an anemia. That's why they have the fatigue, the dyspnea, and the fatigue and the dyspnea, actually. So why do they have the jaundice? They have the jaundice because they have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? So remember that indirect bilirubin is not water soluble, okay? And if you have an increased level of indirect bilirubin in your blood, you can have jaundice. Classically, when your total bilirubin levels go above 2, you begin to have jaundice, okay? Now, why is the haptoglobin low? Because they have a hemolytic anemia, right? Remember, hemoglobin is made of heme and globin. Globin, you break it down into amino acids, so no one really cares about that. But your heme is broken down into iron and protoporphyrin, okay? The thing is that protoporphyrin can ultimately be converted to indirect bilirubin. So if you have a constant breakdown of your red cells, you have an increased production of red cell breakdown product, protoporphyrin, and with that, you have more indirect bilirubin in the serum, okay? Now, why do they have an increase in their urine urobilinogen? They have an increase in urine urobilinogen because remember, that indirect bilirubin gets to the liver, is converted by UDP glucuronosyl transferase, remember that's like phase 2 metabolism, to direct bilirubin that is in fact water soluble, and then that direct bilirubin makes its way to the GI tract, and then the GI flora can convert that direct bilirubin to urobilinogen, okay? That urobilinogen has two fates in the GI tract. It can be converted to stercobilin, that makes your stool like brown or whatever color your stool is. And then the urobilinogen can also be reabsorbed in enterohepatic recirculation, and it can either go back to the liver or it can be converted to urobilin, or you can keep it as urobilinogen and it will just show up in the urine, okay? That's why your urine has the yellow color. So, if a person has an increased production of indirect bilirubin, they will also have an increased production of direct bilirubin, so they will have an increased production of urobilinogen, So more urobilinogen will make its way to the urine. Okay, that's why they have an increased urine urobilinogen. Okay, now they will have no increase in urine bilirubin because they have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Okay, indirect bilirubin is not water soluble. So because it's not water soluble, it does not spill into the blood. And if it does not spill into the blood, it will not show up in your urine. But if a person had some kind of obstructive jaundice where they had a direct hyperbilirubinemia, direct bilirubin is water soluble. Direct bilirubin can spill into the blood. And when it spills into the blood, it can show up in the urine and make the urine look red. Okay? So in an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, there is no increase in urine bilirubin, but in a direct hyperbilirubinemia, there is an increase in urine bilirubin. And there will actually also be a decrease in urine urobilinogen, because if you had a direct hyperbilirubinemia, right, from an obstructive cause, that direct bilirubin is not making its way to the GI tract. So if it doesn't make its way to the GI tract, you are not making any urobilinogen. Okay, so you won't have increased levels of urobilinogen in your urine. Okay, now, and again, your haptoglobin is low because haptoglobin binds up heme. Okay, so let's talk about the Coombs test. Okay, and we said for this person that has autoimmune hemolytic anemia, we're thinking of the direct Coombs test, right? So the thing is, the Coombs test as a phenomenon is primarily associated with helping you detect the presence of antibodies against red cells. Okay, but the thing is, you can do one of two things. You could say, you know what, let me try to find this patient's red cells and see if there are already autoantibodies on those red cells. That's what you do in the direct Coombs test. But if you're like, okay, let me try to see if this person's serum, not their cells, this person's serum has the nasty red cells. I mean, sorry, has the nasty immunoglobulin that binds to red cells. You do an indirect Coombs test. So let's talk about each one by one. So how do you do a direct Coombs test? We said that a direct Coombs test helps you detect if there are antibodies already bound to a patient's red cells. Okay, so the thing you do is that a patient, so like this patient, for example, you literally take their red cells, not their serum, because their serum is what is not what we're concerned about in the direct Coombs test. You take their red cells, okay, and we assume that, oh, these people's red cells already have the bad immunoglobulin on the surface, like IgG, okay? So we take their red cells. If it has that bad immunoglobulin already bound to it, if we add IgM to the mix, that IgM can go and bind to the constant region of that immunoglobulin that is already pre-bound to the patient's red blood cell, okay? And you have agglutination of red cells in that mixture, okay? So that would be a positive direct Coombs test. You can use that to detect the presence of immunoglobulins against red cells that are already bound to the red cell membrane. Okay, but next part says, what is the diagnostic test that will be very helpful in preventing an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction? Well, the test you could use for this scenario, or you could also say for RH incompatibility, is the indirect Coombs test. Okay, so basically for this, you're not saying you're not trying to check for immunoglobulins on the surface of a patient's red cells. What you're trying to do is you're trying to determine if the patient's serum contains immunoglobulin that has the potential to bind to red cells and cause hemolysis. Okay, so you're checking the serum, you're not checking the patient's red cells. Okay, so the thing you do is you literally do like your centrifugation and all that fun stuff, get rid of all of the patient's red cells, okay, and you're left with the patient's serum. The patient's serum is what may potentially contain immunoglobulins, okay? So you take the patient's serum that may have immunoglobulins, and you then give that patient, like, I don't know, like, say, for example, you want to transfuse a patient, right? You're like, okay, this is the donor blood. Let me take red cells from the donor blood and toss it into the patient's serum, right? You toss those red cells into the patient's serum. That patient's serum, if it has antibodies against antigens on the surface of the patient's red cell, okay, those antibodies that are in that recipient serum can bind to the antigens on the surface of the donor's red cells. And then when you add the Coombs reagent in this case, right, so you go ahead and add the IgM that can bind to the constant region of IgG, for example, you then get agglutination. That'll be a positive indirect Coombs test, okay? So again, I'm going to repeat this again because it's kind of important and it's very confusing and many people do not get this for some reason. In a direct Coombs test, you don't do anything with the patient's serum. All you're concerned about is you take the patient, so the recipient, if you may, the patient's actual red cells that already have the immunoglobulin bound to them already, okay? You take the patient's red cells, so you're not doing anything with the serum in a direct Coombs test. You take the patient's red cells, it already has immunoglobulin bound, and then you add Coombs reagent, which is usually IgM, that can bind to IgG, okay? So if that IgM recognizes the constant region of IgG on the surface of the patient's red cells, you can tell that, okay, this person potentially has an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, okay? But in an indirect Coombs test, you are not testing the patient's red cells per se. You are testing the patient's serum, okay? So this has absolutely nothing to do with the patient's red cells, okay? You are taking the patient's serum and you're trying to ask yourself, does this patient's serum contain antibodies that have the ability to bind to red cell antigens? Right, because think about it. If you have a patient that is about to get a blood transfusion, right, you don't want to transfuse blood to a person and sort of transfuse the wrong kind of blood. Like, oh, let's say a patient has type A blood, okay, and you give that patient type B blood. The anti-B antibodies in the patient's serum would attack that type B blood and cause an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction that can actually lead to death, okay? And you usually prevent that by doing this test we're talking about and being a good clerk, if you may, right? So clerical errors are the commonly cited reason for that kind of transfusion reaction. So, if a person, for example, has type A blood and you want to transfuse them, right? With type B blood, for example, and let's say you don't know their blood types natively, you could say, you know what, let me take some serum from this type A blood patient, okay, and take some red cells from this type B donor, okay, and put the red cells of that type B donor, literally like plop them down into the serum of the type A patient, okay. The patient with the type A blood has anti-B antibodies, so obviously we'll have those anti-B antibodies in the serum that can bind to the B antigen on the red cells that have on the red cells that are coming from the donor. Okay, when you have that binding, and then you add Coombs reagent, which is again usually IgM against IgG. Okay, you then get agglutination. Okay, so by doing that, you've said, this recipient's serum actually has antibodies that have the potential to bind to antigens on the surface of the donor red cell, okay? And this test, the indirect Coombs test, is also used with Rh incompatibility because, again, you're trying to test mom's serum for the antibodies of interest, the anti-D antibodies, okay? So, and just real quick, while we're on the topic of like IgM against IgG, I hope that reminds you of rheumatoid factor, okay? A rheumatoid factor is relatively sensitive for rheumatoid arthritis. It's IgM against IgG, okay? So that's the end of this tape. I know this tape was longer, okay? But if you understand what we talked about in this episode, you should be like a hematology, like maestro. Okay, just listen to it carefully, maybe go over it again, but if you can sort of explain this out to yourself, you will probably be able to reason through many hematologic problems that make people scratch their heads on exams. Okay, so if you have any questions or you spotted any errors in this podcast, feel free to reach out to me. The email is divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. I wish you all the best on whatever exams you have in your future, and have a wonderful week and a blessed week ahead. Thank you.